You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2012 Toronto Fraternal Gathering. The speaker is Brother Mark Vincent, and this is the second address in his Young People series entitled God's Hand in the Life of Joseph. And this address is entitled The Hand of God and was recorded on April 7th, 2012.
So if we took all the chapters of the Joseph narrative from chapter 37 through to chapter 50 and said, so what was all that about? What would you say? What's the theme of the Joseph narrative? Well, there's a number of different themes. Well, does anyone want to have a stab at that question? Forgiveness. Yeah, absolutely. Joseph's, there's something else being sent down to me. Forgiveness, Joseph being able to forgive his brothers for what they did to him. Reconciliation, we could put that along with forgiveness, couldn't we? Yeah, excellent. Yeah. Joseph saw God working in his life. Yep, absolutely. So we talked, didn't we, yesterday about this kind of pendulum of Joseph's life. Well, a pendulum goes like that, doesn't it? But the ups and downs of Joseph's life and how Joseph needed to have this constant trust in God when things went wrong that would hold him through that and enable him to carry on. And although he might not have understood it at the time, when he looked back, no doubt he could see how there was a pattern to the things that were unfolding in his life, and that God was doing things for a reason. So that's absolutely one of the key lessons, and that's really the one that we're going to focus on in this session. Any others? Anyone wants to volunteer just while we're on that? Perseverance, yeah, that's a good one, isn't it? Yeah, especially given those ups and downs, not giving up, not saying, well, if that's the kind of thing that's going to happen to me, then I'm going to abandon it. Yeah, good. God bringing good out of evil. Yeah, that's an excellent one. Yeah, and we'll come on to that in a few minutes. Good. Well, let's take those and let's focus in more on this one of God at work in Joseph's life. Would anyone like to give me a definition of the word providence? Anybody know what providence is? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the way that God works in your life and his will. And of course it comes, I mean, you can see it's related to the word provide, can't you? And God providing in every circumstance. So it's providence is more about perhaps the unseen work of God, let's say, than, you know, it's not so much God sent an angel and the angel spake unto him saying, or, you know, a miracle happening, like an obvious miracle, like the water being turned into wine. Those are more sort of blatant acts of intervention by God against what would have happened normally, against the normal laws of things, those examples, aren't they? Providence is more God using the seemingly regular things that people do and that go on in the world, but using them to achieve a particular end and working in our lives through the things that happen. So there are two passages in Genesis where Joseph explains this, and the first one is in chapter 45 and verse 4. So this is after Joseph has made known himself to his brethren. You'll see that in verse 3. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I am Joseph, doth my father yet live? But we're going to come in verse verse 7. And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So do you see that? God sent Joseph before. So God knew a certain circumstance was going to happen, and God made preparation in advance of that. Now, did Joseph know that that's what God was doing at the time when he was cast into that pit and sent down into Egypt? Did Joseph have an explanation of all that was going to play out? I don't think so. I mean, it's possible that he did. That's not recorded. But certainly from what the face of the text tells us, Joseph didn't know what was happening, and he must have felt abandoned, rejected. He must have perhaps there were questions about in his mind there about his faith and about God. Which obviously he survived that questioning. I suspect that he didn't find out till afterwards, and now arriving in this position as Pharaoh's number two and being in charge of all this and seeing his brothers now come for food, it now all starts to click into place for him, doesn't it? And say, oh, wow, that's just incredible. I thought that was a terrible thing, and of course it was a terrible thing. The incident itself was a terrible thing of being sent to Egypt as a slave. And yet, that was all part of God's plan to actually save his people and even his own brothers. So what God did then was to use the free will of the brothers to use... More than that, to use the hatred of the brothers to bring about his own plan. So it wasn't that's not to say that God made the brothers hate Joseph, is it? Obviously they chose, by their own free will, they chose to hate him, but God was able to bring good, which is the point made at the back there, God was able to bring good out of their evil. And that's one of the wonderful things that God can do. God is so creative that he can even bring good out of evil. So now, verse 8, it was not you that sent me hither, but God. Now that's an astonishing thing to say, isn't it? Of course it was them who did it. Of course it was them who grabbed him and stripped his coat off him. But at another level of looking at things, that was all part of God's plan. So that doesn't condone their evil. Their evil was still evil, and it needed to be forgiven, and reconciliation needed to happen. Forgiveness needed to happen. And it's just that, you know, if we were to just flip and consider, well, let's think about the crucifixion of Jesus, and we think about the evil of what men did to him as they hung him on the cross. The fact that this was all in God's plan doesn't make it okay what they did, does it? But... at another level, God knew this would happen, and it was part of his plan. So now, it was not you that sent me hither, but God, and he hath made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. That's quite amazing, isn't it, that he should say, he's made me a father to Pharaoh. So Joseph's only 30 years old, wasn't he, when he went and stood before Pharaoh. And yet he's a father to Pharaoh, which shows that... youth doesn't have to be an obstacle, does it, in terms of what it's possible to achieve if we understand the plan and purposes of God, as Joseph did. And so he urges them to go to their father and say, your son Joseph, thus saith thy son Joseph, God hath made me lord of all Egypt, come down and tarry not. And Joseph promises to nourish his brothers and to feed them. So that's the first of the passages. And if we go to chapter 50, which we've just read, we'll find the second of the passages that describe this way that God was working through these events to save the world. And the parallel with Christ is interesting, isn't it? That it's the brothers' evil, but that God can use that evil that they did to him to good, just as God used the evil that was done to Christ for good in giving Christ as a sacrifice to take away our sins. Now, the passage in chapter 50 that we read is a longer one, but very interesting. Let's work our way through it. So we'll come in at verse 14. And Joseph returned unto Egypt, he and his brethren, and all that went up with him to bury their father. And the brothers were frightened once Jacob was dead, because they thought, well, now Joseph is going to have it in for us now. And so they send a messenger to say, please forgive the evil that we did. And at the end of verse 17, it says, and Joseph wept when they spake unto him. Why did he cry? Anyone any ideas? Yeah?
I don't know. But isn't it some sort of a hint of something messianic to come? Is there like a parallel to him and Christ? Is the reason why Christ wept?
Yeah, so Jesus wept on his way into Jerusalem, didn't he, over the city because of the terrible things that were going to come on it. I see this as being something a little bit different. So let's just read that verse again, verse 17. So shall ye say unto Joseph, forgive, I pray thee now, the trespass of thy brethren and their sin, for they did unto thee evil. And now we pray thee, forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of thy father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Now one option is that he was touched, yeah, by their repentance, by their request that he forgive them. But I don't think that's right. I think the reason why he cries is because they haven't appreciated the fact that he has forgiven them. Yeah? Isn't that it? That they've not appreciated the power and the reality of his forgiveness. He's already forgiven them back in chapter 45. They've already prostrated themselves, and Joseph wept then, didn't he? He wept then and said, it's okay. We just read the passage. It wasn't you who sent me here. It was God. This was all part of God's plan. So don't be angry with yourselves about it. It's okay. But you can see from this passage that the brothers are scared now that Jacob's died, that now Joseph is going to really take his revenge on them. You can see by the very fact that they think that they don't really believe that he has forgiven them fully, that it's really a clean slate, that he really has cast their sins behind his back. And that's why he cries. Yeah. And it's, I suppose, a lesson to us about the level of forgiveness we should try to attain to. That when we forgive people, it should really be gone, just as it was, clearly was, with Joseph. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think that's a good point. Yeah, yeah. So they haven't quite got it, have they? They haven't got the reality of the forgiveness that we can have from each other, or from God, or from Joseph now standing as the Lord Jesus Christ. That reconciliation, that oneness, that potential for oneness with God and with Christ really is real. Yeah. So his brethren now come and fall down before his face and say, "We are thy servants." And Joseph said unto them, verse 19, "Fear not, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, ye thought evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring to pass as it is this day, to save much people alive." So this is the same point that we read in the other passage, isn't it? This is providence being explained again. The people can be doing one thing and thinking they're doing one thing, but God can be working at a different level to bring about his purposes. So we should have this sense then in life that there could be more to it than meets the eye. God could be doing something in these circumstances that are happening in our lives that we don't understand, that seem odd to us, that seem suboptimal to us. God could be working through those circumstances to achieve some particular purpose, which we may or may not understand later in our earthly lives. But that doesn't mean that it's not real, does it? Just the fact that we don't understand it, because our minds are rather small in comparison to God's. So it's about having the trust then to believe that God might be doing something here. Now, and so Joseph goes on in speaking to them and promises to nourish them and to take care of them. And there's another passage which maybe we skipped the verse in the previous passage back in chapter 45, where Joseph says, "Don't be grieved, don't be angry with yourselves that you sold me here." Yeah. And I think that's an important one to think about, because there are times, obviously, when we mess up, just as Joseph's brothers messed up, and the repercussions of messing up can go on a long time, can't they? The repercussions of what Joseph's brothers did to him went on and on and on for years and years, and we'll be talking about more about that this evening. And you have to live with that. You have to live with the consequences of what you've done. But that doesn't mean that you can't be forgiven, even though we have to live with the consequences of it. And so Joseph says to them, "Don't be grieved about it. Don't be angry with yourself." Because that kind of grief and anger doesn't achieve anything, does it? It's backward looking, and it can be self-destructive. So we have to be able to get over what it is that we did and get over ourselves and our own weaknesses, because you know, our salvation and the progress in our lives and the destination that we're going to is not about ourselves. It's not about what we can do for ourselves. It's about what God can do for us and what God's forgiveness can mean. So the fact that we messed up, in a sense, is kind of a sideshow, isn't it? Well, what did you expect? You know, of course we're going to mess up. So don't be grieved about that. Don't live in paralysis because of a mistake that was made, something that you did that was wrong. But learn the lesson from it, and move on and accept the forgiveness. Be prepared to believe in the forgiveness. The things that the brothers failed to do here, and Joseph had to go through it all again and say, "It's okay. God was able to use that." And if we can use those experiences when we get things wrong and build on them to try and be more Christ-like in future, then it's working, isn't it? That's how it's meant to be. That's God using the circumstances of our lives and using even our own weaknesses and failings and even our own evil to bring about good in his purpose, if we use it transformatively. And if we use it in a way which ultimately brings good, brings a better us by God's grace than the us that we left behind. There was something else as well that I think is interesting in this little passage that we skipped over, and it's in verse 15. When Joseph's brethren saw that their father was dead, they said, Joseph will peradventure hate us and will certainly requite us of all the evil that we did unto him. And there's a little three-step process that the brothers go through there in their reasoning that I think is quite interesting. So first of all, they see something. It says, when Joseph's brethren saw that their father was dead. So they observe something that happens. Now, of course, we all do that all the time. We see things that are happening. And then those things that we see need to be interpreted. Well, that's what happens next. And they said, Joseph will peradventure hate us. So this is now at the level of perhaps, isn't it? Perhaps peradventure Joseph will hate us. So we see something and we interpret it and we draw some conclusions, sometimes at the level of perhaps. Perhaps this means this. Now, we need to be careful here because we might be wrong, mightn't we, with our perhaps, as they were wrong with their perhaps, because Joseph didn't hate them, did he? He'd forgiven them and he loved them. And that was why he forgave them, because he loved them. Ben, do you see what the third step is? Joseph will peradventure hate us and will certainly requite us all the evil which he did unto us. So their perhaps has now become a certainly, hasn't it? Yeah? They see, they say, perhaps this means this, and it certainly means this. And there's no logical connection between those things, is there? They're wrong with their perhaps, and they're even wronger about their, or more wrong about their certainly. And but that can be characteristic of the way we think. You know, something happens, we interpret it a certain way, and we say, perhaps it means this, and then we become sure that it means this, and then, you know, we go off and react in some way, and we might be completely wrong in the way that we're reacting. So what do we need to do then? Well, we need to have, I suppose we need to have a sense of our own fallibility, of the fact that the interpretations that we make might be wrong, a sense that there might be more to it than this, there might be another way of looking at this thing that is taking place. So the scriptures use the model of the potter, don't they, of God shaping us and moulding us by the circumstances of our lives. God is making something with us. And we can choose to accept that and say, and yield to his hands, and yield to the circumstances of our lives. Or we can try and force our way and say, well, nope, this is the path that I've determined, and I'm going to go that way, no matter how obvious it comes to be that I shouldn't be going that way. I'm just going to go that way anyway. And that isn't really a very smart way to live our lives. So that then gets us into this very difficult area of what is God's will, doesn't it? Something happens in our lives and we can't not interpret, can we? You know, we have to draw conclusions because you have to carry on. You can't just lie in bed and wait until life happens to you, can you? You have to go out there and live it. And so suppose you think, for example, that you're going to pursue a particular career and doors seem to be closing for that. Perhaps you don't get admitted to a course that you were thinking of going on to do that career. And then you think to yourself, well, so is that God's will, then, that that's not my career and that I go and do something different? Or is God testing my persistence here? You know, there's two ways that you can look at it, aren't there? And it's down to interpretation. Like we were saying yesterday, things don't come with labels on them saying, this means that you should do that you should do this. And this is very, very, very difficult in life. How do we interpret the things that happen? How do we invoke, or is it appropriate to say, well, that must be the will of God, then, that such and such a thing has happened? Well, there's a couple of passages on that I wanted us to think about. How are we doing for time? Let's think first of all about Esther. So we're going to go to Esther chapter 4. And just while you're turning that up, we can think about this in terms of Joseph's life, can't we? That he was plunged into all these different situations, and what we saw was that he got on with it. In whatever circumstance he was put, whether he was cast into the prison, whether he was cast into the pit, whether he was in Potiphar's house, whether he was the prince keeper, whether he was with Pharaoh, it was the same Joseph. He was the same diligent, spiritually focused person. And really, that's sort of the touchstone for us, can't it? That whatever happens, whatever circumstance comes along, there's no use spending too many hours fretting over interpreting it. We have to consider it. We have to bring scriptures to bear about what the right decision is to do in any particular circumstance. And then we have to get on with trying to live our lives and trying to be as spiritual as we can in that circumstance. Let's take Esther and chapter 4. Now, this is when Haman had come up with his plan that he was going to destroy all the Jews. And Mordecai finds out about it, and he tells Esther. And Esther says, well, that doesn't sound good, but I'm in a bit of a fix here, because I can't just go waltzing into Ahasuerus and say, can you do something about this, please? Because if the king doesn't hold out the golden scepter to me, then that's going to be the end of me. And Mordecai answers in this way in verse 13. So, and just before we read verse 13, so Esther's not sure what to do then. She realizes a problem. She's thinking, okay, so should I take the risk? Should I go and speak to Ahasuerus and risk my life? Or should I play it safe and just sort of hang back and see what happens? Well, Mordecai says this. Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place, but thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. So that's important then. So Mordecai is saying, well, whether you're in or out, Esther, God is going to do what needs to be done. God will, if it's God's will to deliver his people, he will deliver them. So you can be sure of that. But then he says something that's very poignant. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And my kids actually had this as a proof text in Sunday school. They were doing Esther, and this was the bit that they had to learn, that phrase there. Who knows whether you are come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So what Mordecai is suggesting here is perhaps this whole thing, Esther, where you won the beauty contest and became the queen, is perhaps it's not about you, no? Perhaps it's not because you were the most beautiful person necessarily, or you would make the best queen, or because God particularly wanted you to be queen as an end in itself. Perhaps it's because God was putting you in that position so that you could go and now and speak to Ahasuerus in this matter. Who knows whether you are come to the throne at such a time as this? And what's the answer to that question? Who does know? Well, Esther didn't know, and Mordecai didn't know. And we don't know, do we? Only God knows whether he put her there for that reason. And Esther was not handed an envelope that explained why she was put there when she was given, when Ahasuerus chose her to be his queen. This has to be interpreted. But the possibility is there, isn't it? The possibility is there that this could be an opportunity for Esther to do God's will. And if she's mistaken about that, and it's not particularly an opportunity, is anything really lost by that in an eternal sense? Maybe not. So Mordecai's point is, so if God could have put you there for this opportunity, then you'd better take the opportunity, hadn't you? What an opportunity that might be. And Esther takes the point. Then Esther bade them return to Mordecai the answer, go gather together all the Jews and have them all pray for me, so that she could be brave enough to take the opportunity and go and speak to Mordecai. And that's exactly what she does. So she takes the opportunity. But I think that's such a powerful verse, because that's exactly how it is in our lives. When something happens, when an opportunity arises, we don't know, do we? Whether, you know, who knows whether this opportunity is for a particular reason in God's purpose? We don't know. But the exhortation seems to be here, well, take the opportunities. Let's have a look at Ecclesiastes and chapter 11. So from the concept of God's will and God bringing things into our lives, you could take an extremist position, couldn't you, that said, and I've kind of caricatured it already, well, I'm just going to sit here and God's will be done in my life and God will make things happen and God will bring opportunities. You know, I'm just going to literally sit down in this seat and God will bring opportunities to me. So is that how it should be? Is that how we should live our lives? And the answer to that is no. We should get on and live them. But we should trust that at another level, God may be working to achieve a particular purpose, and certainly is working in the broad contours of leading us towards his kingdom, because that's what he wants for us, that we should be there with Christ when he returns. And Ecclesiastes 11 makes that point powerfully. Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. Go for it, is the message there, isn't it? And, you know, this is particularly applicable to in spiritual matters, I think. Verse 2, give a portion to 7 and also to 8, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. So go ahead, go on, be generous. That's what it's saying. Take the risk. Take the opportunity. That's what it might be there for. And I like the way it says, be generous, give a portion to 7 and to 8, because you don't know what evil shall be upon the earth. So take the opportunity now while you've got something to give to other people, yeah? So we might have reasoned it the other way, mightn't we? We might have said, well, I don't know what evil is going to be upon the earth, therefore I'd better keep hold of everything that I have just in case I need it, you know, for a rainy day. That's a very natural way of thinking, isn't it? You know, so I'm going to make my pension pot as big as I possibly can, you know, just because I don't know. But here, the reasoning is the exact opposite. It's be generous while you have an opportunity to be generous, because you don't know what's going to happen in the future, and you might not have an opportunity to be generous then. Verse 3, if the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth, and if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there shall it lie. So what's going to happen is going to happen, seems to be the point of that. There is a natural way in which things are going to unfold. He that observeth the wind shall not sow, and he that regardeth the clouds shall not reap. So it's no use sitting there wondering, saying, well, I wonder if it's going to rain today. Maybe I should not go out and plow up and plant my seed in case it rains. Yeah, I'm sure we've all met people like that, people who are all ifs and buts. And this passage is saying, don't spend too much time worrying about all those things. If you see an opportunity, take it. And it may just be part of God's purpose. God may be working something out that we don't realize. verse 5, as thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. So we're not going to get to the bottom of providence. We're not going to understand the great, you know, the details of the architecture of the orchestration of what God is putting together. We know the broad contours and outline of it, certainly, but the details of it, we don't know. But we can be sure that he is working. And so, verse 6, in the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thine hand, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper either this or that, or whether they both shall be alike good. So get on with it. Go out and live your life and try to be the spiritual person that God would want you to be. I want to conclude by talking about the idea of partnership in this. So there's two aspects. There's the aspect of our free will, our ability to choose to do this or that. And there's the aspect of what God is doing in our lives and in the world at large, where he, by providence, is shaping and molding our own characters and the characters of the person next door. God's balancing all those things, isn't he? What it's right to bring into our lives and what it's right to bring into the lives of every one of us here in this room. God is controlling all that. I mean, it's just astonishing, staggering, isn't it, when you stop to think about that. And so what this is then is a partnership between ourselves with the free will that we have and God, who is working out his purpose and fashioning us for a place in his kingdom. And that's just how it was with Joseph. You remember we saw yesterday, when we looked at chapter 39, Joseph with Potiphar and with the prison keeper, we saw there were two things, weren't there? There was the fact that the Lord was with Joseph, and there was also the fact that Joseph didn't stay in bed, that he actually got out of bed and was a diligent servant to Potiphar and to the prison keeper and to God. And when we are working in tandem with God, then amazing things can happen that we would never be able to do in our own strength. The same thing is true if you think about David. So God anoints David and chooses him to be king and gives him the Spirit of the Lord rests upon him. But David still had to find the courage within himself, didn't he? He still had to find the bravery to go out there and to face Goliath. And it was a partnership between himself and God. The last passage I'd like us to look at is Philippians 2. And this highlights exactly the same thing. Philippians 2 and verse 12. Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. So, no one else is going to work it out for you. You've got to work it out yourself. You've got to put the pieces together. You've got to decide what you believe and what you want your identity to be, going back to where we were in the first talk. What is going to occupy you? How you are going to occupy until Jesus comes? Whether you are going to be that shepherd. So you have to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. This is the aspect then of your personal choice, your free will, to decide how you will respond to God's call, to God's summons. But that's not the end of the story, is it? It's not just about you. It's not just about you deciding what you're going to do. There's something else here as well. And it says that in the next verse. For it is God which worketh in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. And you see how it's playing with the same words, isn't it? Work out your salvation You work out your salvation, for it is God who is working in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. And it's interesting how he uses both the will, the desire, what you want. God can help you with that. And what you do, God can help you with that too. And that's the partnership then, isn't it? That we should invite God into our lives so that in partnership then we can prepare ourselves for the kingdom when Jesus comes.